One can well imagine that the typical inmate in an American prison would on any given day love to trade places with the warden. Harder to imagine a senior prison official wanting to trade places with the inmates. But that's exactly what Colorado Department of Corrections Executive Director Rick Ramish decided to do. To experience what an estimated 80,000 inmates go through, in many cases for years, he went into solitary confinement for less than one day, and it opened his eyes. Ramish now believes so-called administrative segregation is overused, and he's become an activist for prison reform, testifying about his experiences before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He told us it didn't take long to realize the severity of the solitary confinement experience.
I was only in there 20 hours, and I don't want to pretend that I had a true experience of what it would be like when the average time spent in administrative segregation in Colorado is 23 months, and we've had some that have spent years and years in it, but it gave me insight into what years in there would do to an individual of simply staring at a wall and the isolation that one feels. It definitely is not a good thing.
What moment stood out to you in those 20 hours or moments?
Very quickly, I lost all concept of time, and I broke a self-imposed rule when the correctional officers came around, whether it be to serve a meal or to do a cell check. I swore I wouldn't ask them what time it was, and finally I had to know because I had no idea at all. I just thought very quickly that it wouldn't take too long for this to really mentally affect me.
What would you do differently now? What lessons are you trying to implement?
We are looking and evaluating virtually every reason that we place someone in administrative segregation and what period of time we do that for. I've always said that segregation is a story with no ending. And one of the things we're doing is we're going to ensure that if a person does have to go in, that they'll know when they're going to get out. And what hits me and certainly did when I was sitting in that cell with nothing to do but think was that by the use of administrative segregation, we're missing part of our primary mission. And when I say that, what I mean is that by having someone sit in there for long periods of time, what we're doing is suspending a problem and sometimes multiplying it. And what we're certainly doing is sending someone out in the community a lot worse than they came in. And that's not what our job is. We're supposed to, prepare them for release back into society from the first day they enter our institutions, because 97% of our population will return to the community.
Do you believe that the prison system in America has become a dumping ground for the mentally ill? And does solitary confinement become a kind of warehouse approach to dealing with people with serious mental illnesses?
Here's what every corrections director in the United States will say, and I'm saying it too, is that the Department of Corrections is the largest mental health institution in the state. So we are a dumping ground. We have been for years. When we deinstitutionalized mental institutions years ago, those that were released started that long walk from the mental health institutions into the state prison system. And I believe administrative segregation long term either multiplies or manufactures mental illness. And I will accept the fact that I'm supposed to be running a mental health institute. The problem is with all states is that we haven't been given the staff historically to do that. And that's one thing Governor Hickenlooper and the legislature here has been willing to take a look at the problem and see what additional resources we need.
Are you getting any pushback from the corrections employees who may think that Director Ramish has become a softy now? 20 hours and boom, he doesn't really understand what we need to do to keep order in these prisons.
I'd be foolish to say that's not happening, because it certainly is. There are some that truly believe in what we're doing, and there's others that think that I'm endangering them by keeping individuals out of administrative segregation. But what I feel and what I believe is that if we solve the problem that caused the person to be put in there to begin with, what will happen is we'll have a much safer institution instead of a more dangerous one.
Rick Ramish is Executive Director of the Colorado Department of Corrections. Rick Ramish, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Stepping into the experience of inmates caught in the deepest recesses of the U.S. prison system is also the mission of a new CNN series put together by Academy Award-winning documentary filmmaker Alex Gibney, collaborating with narrator Susan Sarandon and producer Robert Redford. The 8 episodes of Death Row Stories take viewers into a world that often seems beyond the justice system, where the innocent can simply get lost in procedures and legal tangles that make it almost impossible for the system to admit its own mistakes. Gibney calls the stories murder mysteries that end up saying something disturbing about the way capital punishment is administered in America.
We originally started doing this because we were interested in these life and death stories of people on death row. And as we dug into each one of these individual stories, we discovered patterns that really revealed something very problematic about the system. But we didn't do a kind of systematic report. We did purposefully individual stories.
And in the individual stories, one of the patterns is how cases sort of lost in the files, lost in the archives, become a cause célèbre for a very unusual collection of individuals, such as in episode 1. Here's a clip.
One day, the prosecutor in my case came to the prison to visit, and he said, "I just want you to know that you don't have to be what you did that day, and you can be somebody." And why wouldn't every prosecutor want to do that?
The emotion of wow. Diana Holt. Tell us about her.
She's a fantastic character. She is a person who started out basically as a legal intern and then fixed on to this case as she slowly became a lawyer and single-handedly worked to get this guy who was wrongly accused, wrongly convicted, not only off of death row but finally exonerated. But one of the things that's so poignant about that clip that you played is basically she's talking about a moment when she had something in her past which prosecutors raised to try to discredit her. She had been convicted of a crime, basically trying to steal some money from somebody who turned out to be a police officer. And the prosecutor said, you know, you don't have to let this destroy your life. You can change. And she starts to weep, like, why wouldn't all prosecutors behave that way? Because one of the appalling things, one of the things we discovered about the system is the system seems very unwilling to admit its own mistakes and also very unwilling to accept the idea that people can change. So it becomes this kind of forbidding mechanism whereby people can achieve a kind of certainty, shut the door, maybe shut the door to those Indiana Jones archives, and then just walk away and feel, you know, job done.
And the appeals process becomes a kind of empty symbol of justice, which actually never accomplishes anything because there's so many ways for the system to go, hey, sorry, we can't really reopen this here. In episode 2, there's a focus on a character who has the experience of telling people this is a mistake and not being listened to. Here's Gloria Killian.
The more I said I didn't know, the angrier it made them. One of them spent the time just staring at me, staring in my eyes. But I still didn't have anything to tell them.
A detective handcuffed Gloria for the trip to county jail.
He said, "You are going someplace that no nice little white girl like you has ever been, and we will break you."
Gloria Killian, who eventually did go to that place where no nice little white girl has ever been, and Susan Sarandon, they're reading the narration there. Tell me about that character and the individual who found her case as a cause célèbre.
The mother of Sally Ride.
Amazing.
Amazing. And there always seems to be a champion, you know, one person who somehow believes in the Joe D'Ambrosio case, which is another one. A priest discovered D'Ambrosio and then, you know, initially thought he was guilty and then realized he was innocent. There's usually some advocate who feels so passionately that a wrong has been done that they're determined to try to make it right. But you see how people get caught in the system, and there's such a determination. Part of it is, I think, our adversarial system, which is not necessarily about truth. It's about, you know, winning or losing, because it's ultimately very hard to know precisely what the truth is.
I'm wondering if you worry that as heroic as these stories are, people will watch this series and conclude, oh, great, that's the check on the system. You know, ladies here and there, legal interns here and there who take on these cases for emotional reasons and get people exonerated. When that's really not the case.
No, it's not. And these are really the exceptions to the rule. And we have to recognize that a lot of people who we now know as innocent have been put to death. And let's look at it from the conservative perspective. It's like, you know, there are a lot of people who are upset about government intruding into our healthcare system, for example. But, you know, if you don't want to blindly trust the government to protect our health, do you really want it to administer our death?
You know, the eighth episode here, we've talked a lot about the archives of Indiana Jones and how cases get lost. Episode eight is really about how cases on death row, while they can be obscure for years and years and years during the appeals process, when suddenly a governor is asked to possibly grant clemency, then all of a sudden it explodes into the Klieg lights of national politics. And that's exactly what happened in the case in your episode eight. Describe the case of a 19-year-old Nathan Dunlap.
Well, Nathan Dunlap is a guy who walked into a Chuck E. Cheese and executed a number of people, I think it's fair to say. And it was a brutal, bloody crime. And I think there's no question that Dunlap did that act. And there was a lot of press about him talking about it in very cold terms that horrified everyone. And so now it's become quite a public case, and actually it's become quite political. And that was one of the things I think that interested us in the story, where the electoral process is basically tugging over whether or not he should be killed. It's almost like, elect me and I will kill this person. So that's the one in which we really examine these issues. And they're tough issues. Look, from an emotional perspective, if you have a relative who's murdered in cold blood, you know, you want payback. But I think it gets into this debate about how does the state administer that justice over time and with a system that seems deeply flawed. But yes, one of the great things about that show is that it's going to focus it in real time on a moment that's going to decide the governorship of Colorado.
Alex Gibney, Oscar-winning director of Taxi to the Dark Side, Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, The Armstrong Lie, and over a dozen other films. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.